Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 45 featuring Alex Alvarez. Many of you may know Alex as the founder of Noman School. He's actually a really interesting person, and we met him at THU. Trojan Horse was a Unicorn, and this is another one of our series of THU podcasts where we talk about education, art education, and he has a lot of very strong opinion about it based on very personal experience, which I think is really cool. And we have Kristen joining us today.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good. So you recently graduated from school. Mm-hmm. Where did you graduate from?
I went to Loyola Marymount University.
And what was your major in?
Animation.
Animation. Okay, that major did not exist when I was in school. So an animation major, right? And you are going out there in the field and you're trying to find a job, right? So how is it? What's it like? What's the atmosphere out there right now? Besides the fact you have a job right now, you're working with us, so it's great. but what other things, what is it like out there?
Oh gosh, it's hard. I've learned it's all about who you know, basically.
Yes.
And how to get a job in the field.
Yeah.
And
that's never changed.
Yeah, it's never changed.
No.
But I don't know. I feel like I used to think that my talent would get me in, but it's 90% who you know.
Well, it's also timing, right?
You have
to be there at the right time and location. Now, the thing is, you know, the way I used to think is like, as long as I'm in an area where people are going to be looking for people, then I'm going to be in good shape. I can't be, you know, in Tulsa, Oklahoma, waiting for a phone call from someone in LA waiting for me to be out here. I have to be in LA or in this case, Vancouver or wherever else you're going to be. So be in the location where it's going to be. So that's an interesting part of it. I also want to ask something else because this came up before as well. A friend of mine contacted me on Facebook and said on the podcast, I was like, you should get more women on your podcast, which of course is another issue. So women in animation, was there a lot of women in your class?
Yes, there was like, I think about 70% women.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
That's very encouraging.
Yeah.
So this is a new generation because I think that's going to be great to see a lot more women in the VFX world, in the CG world, in the animation world.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very encouraging. So hopefully we'll be able to do that. Because when I started at Digital Domain and I was working in a digital building, the building had about maybe 120 people and there were 3 women.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was very different. And I know that's an atmosphere that's changed. So I'd really be really encouraged the fact that you guys have so many women graduating from school. And it's a field that I think definitely needs that sensitivity.
Mm-hmm.
How are your friends? Are your friends finding jobs? You know?
We're all struggling together, finding a job.
Yeah.
It's a lot of, you kind of have to, I don't know, go inside yourself and have to really face your inner thoughts,
yeah.
which is really interesting and hard. But once you get through it, makes yourself a lot better and for the industry and, I don't know, a lot stronger.
Yeah. Well, that's cool. All right. Well, this has been a really good intro. I think I wanted to make sure that we had some perspective about what it's like from the student's perspective. And now, when you guys listen to it, hopefully you enjoy it. You'll see why Alex did exactly what he did and why he founded Noman. Just a couple of quick announcements. We will be at RFX on November 5th. We'll be giving a presentation there. RFX is in Hollywood, in case you happen to be in the Los Angeles area. And speaking of Alex Alvarez, we will actually be at Noman on November 19th for the THU meetup that's happening over there. So for more information on that, we will be stand by and check out our email or social media to find out about that. All right. Thanks, guys.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has for now.
All right. All right, Alex.
Yep, yep. Here we go. At least I slept.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been amazing. We were just talking about it, so we should probably share with people about the vibe of this conference and how you think about it. What do you think about it?
Well, I think the main difference is just that we're stuck on this peninsula, and so nobody, you know, can really leave the event. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is a huge part of what creates this atmosphere of people being friendly and wanting to get to know the people that are in the room. And, you know, instead of people dispersing through right. a city with the people they came with, like, everybody's just sticking together. So you have hundreds of people that are in the hotel lobby every day and in the casino every night. And I think people are making more friendships here than they usually do.
And there's events. And there, and like you said, there's 14 or 18 hours worth of stuff going on every day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it starts at 9 and goes until 3 in the morning.
Right.
I mean, that's unheard of. Yeah. You know, pretty much every event that I've been to is over by 6 or maybe 7 o'clock, and then everybody yeah. takes off for the evening.
And then they go to separate little parties and little clicky things, right?
Right, exactly.
Here, everyone is together all the time.
Yeah.
All the time.
And since it's, you know, I mean, I got here on Sunday, I leave on Monday, so it's like it's also a pretty long event.
Yeah.
And so that gives you, you know, a lot of time to slowly meet more and more people. So every day I'm meeting, you know, a new group of people. So by the end of the week, it's like I've made so many new connections.
Right.
You know, and discovering people that, you know, the industry is so big and there's so many talented people that you haven't heard of. And that's a big thing that you discover here.
Right. And yeah. I think another thing that's very important that Andre and Scott both do is to remove all egos. There's no such thing as a VIP or anything. So mm-hmm. anyone can talk to anyone, and he encourages that as much as possible.
Yeah.
No one's separated, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And that's super important, because I think, like, especially for, you know, students, because I think students are, you know, usually really intimidated.
Right.
Because they think that people are unapproachable, and, you know, students need to understand that everybody's just a person, and everybody's normal, and everybody has the same issues, and everybody went through the same stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so
someone might have gone through it 25 years ago, but it's right, the same thing.
But yeah, everybody relates, you know, mm-hmm. so like our crowd is a very friendly crowd,
right.
But you don't necessarily just know that at the beginning when you're starting. So yeah. I think, you know, when I was starting, I was pretty scared of approaching people. I didn't want to bother people.
Right.
You know, and I think Andre's collected a group of speakers and, you know, that are all very friendly, open people.
Right.
So it's awesome.
And speaking of beginnings, mm-hmm. what I want to, your talk about the state of art education
mm-hmm.
was amazing to me. I thought it was really, really great because you made it so personal, and I've known you for a while, and I love Noman. Obviously, I mean I've done a bunch of DVDs for it. I still get recognized for those DVDs, which is awesome.
That's cool.
And so it was kind of one of a wonderful thing. But I understood so much more why you did it, mm-hmm. and there's a passion behind it that I think is, even though we'll talk about art education, because I'm going to cover you on a couple questions that mm-hmm. that I still have, but you explain exactly the passion behind it
mm-hmm.
and why you developed that passion and how that happened for you. And I think that's a marvelous thing to share. And I'd love for you to be able to share that with some of the people out there and how you got frustrated with art education and what drove you to make it yourself.
Right. Well, initially it was the lack of art education.
Exactly.
You know, so the lack of exposure and, you know, I mean, obviously in kindergarten, like, you know, when kids are 5 to 10, there's lots of drawing, and that's probably still around. But from the age of 10 on, I think that, you know, for most people, that as a priority goes away. That mm-hmm. for a 5-year-old, it's fine to draw. That's considered normal.
Mm-hmm.
But once you get a little bit older, that's considered to be a hobby. That's considered to be a distraction. And so, you know, so my frustration is just that I was always interested in drawing, but while other kids were shifting away from that, you know, me and like the art clique of kids in mm-hmm. elementary school, high school, I continued to do it, and that we got no recognition for that. We got no support for that. There were no classes to take. There were no counselors to tell us that it was all right to be doing that, that that was a good hobby to have, that that could turn into something.
Right.
We actually got the opposite of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people telling us not to do that, that you had to get a real job, whatever that meant.
Right, whatever that meant, yeah.
You know, and that I think that also, unfortunately, is that for people like me, who as a kid was into Star Wars and, you know, science fiction and fantasy and comic books, and, you know, I just, you know, go to the bookstore and discover Frazetta or Boris Vallejo or Michael Woodruff or Michael
right.
Whelan, like the only art books you could get at the time,
mm-hmm.
Gustave Doré, and, you know, I was so into that stuff. But the art teachers that we did have in high school, the couple, were fine artists.
Yeah. And that, tell me the difference, because you mentioned that very specifically. I think it's extraordinarily important to explain the difference that you feel between fine art and art. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. I mean, I appreciate fine art. I don't have a personal issue with it. It's just not for me, right? Gallery art, abstract art. It's not my thing because I'm into illustration. I'm into illustrative art,
right.
You know, things that are representational,
right.
Like whether it's figurative work or whatever, like that's what I'm into. And so, but the fine art world, the people I was exposed to anyway as teachers, mm-hmm. you know, looked down on that. So if you were interested in drawing superheroes as a kid, or you were into drawing creatures, that's not what they really wanted you to be doing. They wanted you to be conceptual. They wanted you to be focusing on, you know, the concept and the idea and of what you were doing. Mm-hmm. And as a teenager, I just was drawing because I thought it looked cool. You know, I was picking comic books based on the art and just not so much based on the story of the comic. It was flipping through and digging the artists that I like, and that's how I was picking things.
Right.
And so I just found it frustrating that ultimately what ended up creating a lot of resentment is that, you know, to go and spend the ages of 12 to 18 focusing so much on academics, you know, so much homework and so much stuff to do with math and history and things that are important subjects, but no focus at all on art, is that I then ended up going to college thinking I had to find a real job.
Right.
And spent 2 years there taking a whole bunch of different classes.
And let's just put it in context. You did fairly well in your academics, despite your passion for art. You went to UPenn. It's a fantastic school, right?
Right.
I mean, that's an Ivy League school. You went mm-hmm. there. You got accepted. It's not the fact that you were like, I suck at education and I'm not that smart and therefore I want to be an artist.
Right.
You were all rounded. You just, there was a drive in you that was lacking, right?
Yeah. I mean, well, my parents were very, you know, serious when it came to academics and grades. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I had to do well. It wasn't a choice. You know? And when I was 12, they sent me to a private school where, you know, an all-boys private school where it was just the only thing was academics. It was hardcore. There was so much homework, especially for those ages, mm-hmm. you know. And the only focus, the success was measured on if you got into an Ivy League school.
Right.
You know, and so for those years, the priority was like, you have to do well in school. You have to do good grades. You have to do extracurricular activities. You have to play sports. You have to be in clubs. You have to, you know, do all of these things that will look good on a application for an Ivy League school.
Mm-hmm.
And so that took a lot of my time that I could have spent focusing on the thing that I actually really innately liked, which was art.
Mm-hmm.
So I did, you know, I went through what I was required to do and expected to do. I didn't feel like I had a choice.
Right.
You know, and so, yeah, I got into an Ivy League school, which for a lot of people would have been the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, it wasn't the right place to be.
Right.
You know,
I think it's pretty ballsy to take that decision, you know, and make that choice happen. I know when you're 19, when you left, right?
I was 20 when I left. Yeah.
And I know that sometimes you can make a decision like that at 20 and go, screw it, you know?
Yeah. Well, I had to pick a major.
You know,
the end of your sophomore year, you have to pick a major.
Yeah, right, of course.
And
there's the dilemma.
And, you know, when you're surrounded by friends and they're all, most of them knew freshman year what their major was going to be.
Right.
And I had no clue, mm-hmm. you know, and so there was no way that I could pick one of those subjects like history or math or science or communications.
And you were telling me about even at UPenn, like the mm-hmm. art department there was like...
It was really small. I mean, it's my... You know, obviously I told my college counselor that I liked in high school that I liked to draw.
Mm-hmm.
But, and so he told me that, oh, of course, you know, all the Ivy League schools have great art departments.
Mm-hmm.
Not really knowing what he was talking about. So when I got to Penn, turns out they had a established graduate school art department for fine art.
Uh-huh.
But for undergrad, out of 8,000 students, it was really just eight.
Eight.
Eight. Out eight. Of 8,000.
Right.
Meaning it just was not a department that was focused on. And I did take a couple of the art classes that they had at Penn, but mm-hmm. they were completely fine art.
Right.
You know, it was all conceptual. It was all, you know, like something that it was in my presentation, but I didn't have time to talk about it. It was an assignment we had called The Trap.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the assignment in a sculpture class. And I I made a plasticine creature toilet. So it was a toilet with like teeth and eyes and, you know,
right.
that was my thing. And I thought it was cool and presented that. And I got a D. And this other student came in with a ladder, like a regular ladder, and set it up in the middle of the room and had a piece of paper cut out in the shape of a leaf that she put on every rung of the ladder and had like an essay that she read to go with it. And she got an A. And I mean, I did not know how to react to that. You know, it's like, I mean, I thought what I did required some skill.
Right.
That to me meant being an artist, you know, visual communication as opposed to writing.
Right.
And it seemed like in an art class, the teacher was more interested in your ability to think than to create visually. And obviously thinking and problem solving is an important part of our industry.
Sure.
But you know what I'm saying? It was really frustrating.
Well, you know, art's a form of expression. Let's, you know, we can say that. And I'm not trying to, you can say that on all sides, either fine art or the art that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. But I had a similar experience because I was an art major in, I was an art and math major in undergraduate. Okay. Right. And I loved math and I loved art and I had a great time doing it. But I was clearly a different brained person than the other people in the majors there, right? And we had some assignment, I think it was for printmaking or some one of the classes. And I was taking some pretty advanced math classes, topology, abstract algebra and stuff at the time. And I saw huge amounts of beauty in mathematics and creativity in mathematics. And so I felt somehow, I was like, I'm gonna share this because this is, you know, when you get excited about art and you see something, it's like, oh, that's awesome. Mm-hmm. I had the same things when I saw certain mathematical expressions, right?
Right.
So I made a thing that was like, the whole idea is that there was a hypothesis and a problem and a hypothesis, and you have to prove from A to B, right? Mm-hmm. And I showed one way to do it, which was long and elaborate, and then I showed another way that was really simple. And I was saying that, you know, this to me is beauty, seeing where this went from that. Mm-hmm. The simplicity of the problem solving was innate beauty. Mm-hmm. And I sort of put it out there. And I did it in a really nice way. I typed it out, I wrote it, and it was just kind of this thing. And they hated me for it.
Yeah.
They hated me for it because they felt like I was saying they're not smart enough.
Right.
And it was like, don't take it so personally. It's like, how do you critique art, first of all? Mm-hmm. You know? And it's kind of bullshit, you know, because you can't just sort of go and goes, well, you know, just like you, it's like you're just, you know, diminishing it down to a toilet or whatever. It's like, that was really funny. That was good.
Right.
And what's wrong with that?
Exactly. So, I mean, the fine art world, certain people in the fine art world, and maybe it's different now, I don't know, because I don't follow it, just look down on illustration.
Yeah.
You know, and they look down on, you know, fantasy art and science fiction art. And
just beautiful technique and light and color and everything else.
It's something that they feel is like the past, that's over, you know, that thanks to things that changed because of the invention of the camera and what happened in the art world because of that, that the need to be representational in art no longer existed and now it could be conceptual.
Right.
And I appreciate the idea, and a lot of great art has come out of that.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean that... you know, people who are into fantasy art and sci-fi art and entertainment design and whatever aren't artists. Obviously they are. And I think most of us think that there's a lot more talent in our industry than what you're going to see in a lot of the fine art galleries you're going to go to around the world.
Yeah, but you're also inventing new worlds. I mean, it's a lot of the fantasy art is about inventing new worlds and illustrating a new mood and idea and something that's exciting, right?
So the frustration in the end was just like not being supported by anybody. You know, it's like not being supported by my parents, not being supported by the school system, not being supported in high school, getting to college and having the same experience, and then dropping out of college and finding my thing, you know, because I got a job when I dropped out of college coloring comic books. So that, you know, all of a sudden I realized there were people like me.
Yes.
But once I realized I wanted to get into 3D computer graphics and had to get access to Silicon Graphics computers, and they were expensive, so I had to go somewhere that had them, and I went to Art Center and studied illustration, the same thing kind of happened to me there, which is, all right, I'm in illustration, but my interest is to get access to the Silicon Graphics labs.
Right.
And this is, you know, in like 93.
Mm-hmm.
And so at that point, everybody in illustration, teachers, classmates, whatever, were like, why are you wasting your time
with computers
in the SGI labs?
Right.
You know, like that's cheating. Like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
You know, like you should be in the drawing studio, you should be painting, you know, and obviously I did a ton of life drawing and painting because that's what you had to do as an illustration major.
Yeah. And I saw your stuff that you were showing. It was amazing. It was good.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's because I always, you know, I was into drawing my whole life. So I'm happy that I had that experience of having to do all that foundation stuff. But again, I wasn't getting supported, you know, and a lot of the teachers that I had in illustration were actually fine artists. And so again, it was this frustration that like people didn't understand what I was into and were looking down on me for it.
Right.
And so that just created a lot of pent up frustration, you know, of just like that in hindsight, you know, that when I look at my drawings from when I was 10, right? Like it's pretty obvious that I was a kid who liked to draw.
Right.
You know, and today with what I know about the industry and having a school and all that kind of stuff is that I know that if I went to a group of 10-year-olds and said, all right, who's the artist here? Right. They'd all know because kids know who likes to draw, right?
Right?
And they'd point to that kid or those two kids. And if you went to that kid and said, you know, what do you want to do when you grow up? They'd probably say, I don't know. Do you like to draw? I love to draw. Well, would you like to, like, you know, that you could draw or design creatures for movies? Or do you play video games? Yeah. It's like, you know, you could work at a studio that makes video games and like get paid to do that.
Right.
You know, like they would have no idea. And of course they'd be like, that would be freaking awesome. Cause that's what kids say. Cause I've talked to kids cause I have kids.
Right.
And, but nobody's having that conversation at all anywhere, you know, other than the children of artists.
Right.
You know, like that's definitely something like when I went to college in my freshman year at Art Center, like in our first term, there were people like me that were kind of average, you know, and then there were some kids that were amazing.
Right.
You know, just like so much better than everybody else in
and
term
they happened
one.
To be,
they were the children of artists.
Right.
You know,
because that was, they supported that.
Yeah. From 5 years old that their parents told them like, hey, you know, if you like to draw, awesome.
The other example you said was fantastic. I love the example, which is perfect, was that, you know, everyone talked about Michelangelo was drawing the Sistine Chapel at 25 or how old was he? He was 22.
In his mid 20s.
In mid 20s, right? Yeah. And it's like, it's incredible. It's like, but he was identified as an artist at 10.
Right, exactly.
And, you know, that he was brought in and he was made as an artist and had the training at the age of 10.
Yeah, and Picasso as well. You know, I mean, you can see Picasso's drawing, figure drawings when he was 12 years old, and they are unbelievable.
Yeah.
Because, you know, kids. You know, kids are sponges and kids definitely, if they're exposed to something they like to do, will do it obsessively.
Right.
You know, it's like if I let my son play World of Warcraft for 14 hours, he will play World of Warcraft for 14 hours, you know? And so with drawing, it's the same thing. And so if you, you know, tell a kid, all right, you have to, kids are used to the fact that they have to study, that they have to go to school. But most of the assignments they had, classes they have to do, they think are boring. That's just the nature that we have. What most of us remember of high school and whatever is that we weren't really that into most of the subjects, but we felt we had to do it.
Right.
So if you take that mindset, you know, of a 10-year-old or a 12-year-old and you put them into art school where their homework every day is to do, you know, creature design, vehicle design, product design, production design, study art history, study film history, see cool movies, read cool books, you know, just fill their head, start at 10. The rate of change you see in anyone from 10 to 20 is very dramatic.
Right.
You know,
because their brains are still absorbing and they're capable of doing so
and
much.
And so I think, you know, can you catch up to somebody? If you don't start till you're 20, can you catch up with somebody who started when they were 10?
Right.
You know, it's like because of the dynamic of what happens in your brain from 10 to 20.
Right.
So I just think it's the world would be a different place if, you know, the arts were more supported. And ultimately, I think if you talk about the function of elementary school, K through 12 and college, it's to launch careers.
Sure.
Right. It's for people to find themselves and figure out what they want to do for a living. And so everybody's exposed to English, and that's important because communication is important regardless of what job you have. It's hugely important in our industry because it's collaborative. You're exposed to math and science, and that's important for critical thinking. And you're exposed to physics, let's say. But like everybody's exposed to physics. You know, I had 2 years of physics in high school, right? And so I had honors physics and AP physics. What percentage of people become physicists?
Yeah, exactly.
And what percentage of people become artists?
Right.
You know, what percentage of people have the inclination to be able to become a physicist versus an artist? Because I remember in high school, I was always really good at math and science.
Sure.
So like I was always getting A's and doing well and thought this it was that might be for me, trying to figure out this real job I'm supposed to have. And I started reading Carl Sagan and I got really into astrophysics and I thought maybe that's something I could do.
Right.
And so I kept taking all the science classes and then it was like, all right, senior year, I'm going to take AP calculus and AP physics. And it was really hard.
Yeah.
All of a sudden it went from being like something I could wrap my head around to something really, really, really difficult. And there were two students in my class right? So you have a class of pretty smart kids at a private school, and our teacher was designing the tests so that you couldn't get more than 50% of the questions right.
Okay.
They were really, really stressful. It was the football coach who was the calculus teacher. So okay. This huge 6'5", massive dude who screamed all the time. Mm-hmm. And on those tests, everybody would get, you know, like 40% to 50% of the questions right, and these two kids would ace them. Right. Every time, even though there was stuff on these tests.
They blew the curve.
Yeah. And one of them went to MIT and the other one went to, I think, Harvard or Stanford and are now physicists.
Right.
Right. Meaning like their brains were wired differently.
Right.
Like because all the other students in the class, we were all just like, how the hell were you able to ace this test?
Yep.
And their brains were just wired a little differently when it came to math and science.
Sure.
And it's the same thing with art. You know, some people have a little bit more of an inclination and interest and passion for, let's say, art. But why is everybody exposed to physics, but nobody's exposed to art?
Right.
You know, I think an equal percentage of the population has a potential to go into art than physics. Mm-hmm. There's probably more jobs, definitely today, because of the entertainment industry in the arts, especially if you include industrial design, graphic design, architecture, and whatever. Mm-hmm. So if the purpose of school is to allow people to start career paths that are successful and rewarding, mm-hmm. it just makes no sense for art to be excluded. And it makes even less sense for the education budget cuts to be cut as a whole, but art and music and are being identified as a larger target.
Right.
So in Los Angeles with the LA Unified School District, like almost half the schools have completely cut art and music.
Right.
So the fact that kids from age 5 to 18 now in Los Angeles, and this is happening in a lot of other cities and a lot of other countries, mm-hmm. have no art classes at all. Mm-hmm. It makes no sense.
It makes no sense, especially in a city where there's a demand for people with creative jobs.
You know, and you know, the recession in 2008, you know, it's like we know what happened there with the banks and what happened with real estate and what happened. And, the, you know, there was a stimulus package, mm-hmm. right, that Obama put together. That was $800 billion stimulus package. And it included $50 million out of $800 billion for the arts. And Congress cut it. So they're trying to stimulate the economy. The only, you know, one of the only sectors of the economy
no one
that
understands
survived
the purpose of art. Yeah.
Yeah, that survived the recession and grew during the recession was mm-hmm. the entertainment industry,
right.
The game industry and the film industry, because people still go to the movies and people still play games when there's a recession. So you have, you know, our industry is actually still employing people and not letting people go through that time. And like the government just doesn't acknowledge it because we don't have the lobbyists that other industries do to educate, you know, people in charge, you know, about what this represents. And unfortunately, we now have a situation that's been around for decades where most politicians and most parents really think that if you like to draw, that means you're going to be Van Gogh. Like a lot of parents, that's their worry because they care about their children. They don't want you to be the starving artist. They don't want you to be broke.
And that's such a traditional, that's.
But it hasn't gone away.
No, it hasn't gone away.
And even today with the internet and the access to information, behind the scenes stuff on Blu-rays and whatever,
right.
We still have parents all the time coming into Noman, you know, with their children with this concern. Mm-hmm. Is this real? Like, can you really do this for a living?
Well, it says, look at anything that you touch. It's been designed and made by something. One, an artist made a picture of that before it was built.
Yeah.
Everything needs, and that is representational art as well, which is also an important part of things, you know?
Right.
And you're not going to be.
Yeah.
It's
people are blind to it, and it's weird because it surrounds you. Anybody goes, on a trip to Europe or goes to Paris, and what do they do when they're there? They go to the museums. They look at the art. They go to Notre Dame. They look at the cathedrals. They admire the architecture. They admire the beauty of it.
Everything that is good in history is represented through art.
Right. So so really everybody appreciates that and yet doesn't make the connection that any of that stuff was designed by a person.
Right. So we may have a void of art in this time, but I don't think that is the case because obviously we're seeing it. It's just not appreciated.
It's not appreciated and therefore kids aren't getting support. So the fact that my story resonates with so many people just shows that things aren't that different today than they were 20 years ago when I went through it.
Okay, so let's go back a little bit because were you at Craig Mullins' talk today?
I was sleeping.
I understand. And you know Greg very well, obviously, because he does.
Yeah, I'll see him tonight.
Yeah. But he was a little nervous, okay? So he just kind of started a little bit down the line and then he started realizing the crowd may have more experience than he was thinking. He was thinking much more student-oriented, mm-hmm. but there were people there with jobs, but frustrations similar to what we have. Mm-hmm. But then based on this conversation, he someone was asking about, you know, how is it that I have to work so hard and go out there and get, you know, to get a job and to get a good job. And he was saying, well, the art world is super competitive because there's so many people that are so good at art right now. And I was like, okay, so here's the dilemma, right? And I'll go back to your point because you actually were talking about another problem, which is, which I'll get to. So hold the thought. I asked a question. So if it's really hard to get jobs or get good jobs, and people in Portugal are complaining, like, I'm an artist, I can never find a good job here. I cannot get a, you know, illustration or whatever. So there's a supply and demand problem. There's actually a lot of people that are artists or consider themselves artists out there, not enough jobs.
Right.
Now, there is a demand for art, but not as direct. And there is no support for artists because the number one thing that he said, Greg, was like, well, how is Portugal's government at supporting the arts? And they all laughed. Everyone laughed because obviously Portugal doesn't necessarily...
They're not supporting this event at all.
No, they're not supporting this event and they're not supporting... But you brought that up in your presentation as well. Exactly. Do you remember the numbers? What's the budget of the government per year and how
3.9,
much?
Yeah, well, the government has a budget of 3.9 trillion. So that's how much they spend.
3.9 trillion a year.
Right. Yeah.
This is the US government.
The United States government. Yeah. So, yeah, in that slide, if you add up the different things related to defense, the Department of, you know, Homeland Security to the CIA to any military related spending, it adds up to about 650 billion of the budget.
Right. So that's like almost 20%.
Yeah. And that's a lot of money.
Yeah.
For a country that is surrounded by water.
Right.
And Mexico and Canada. Nobody's about to invade us anytime soon. We meddle in everything unnecessarily, in my opinion.
Right.
And we're spending $650 billion on war and defense.
Right.
The entire education budget, you know, for the Department of Education is around 60 billion. So 10% of what we spend on war and defense for education. 20%,
so 2% of our budget is spent on education.
Yeah.
Of our entire budget.
And of that, 1 billion is spent on arts funding. But with that 1 billion, that's local plus state plus federal.
Right.
Because the federal budget I'm talking about is just federal. But for that number, I just, you know, added up. What do local governments, state governments, and the federal government combined spend on arts funding?
Right.
That's $1 billion.
Right.
Out of $3.9 trillion. So, like, this year, we're going to spend $1.6 billion on two airplanes.
Right.
$800 million per bomber.
Right. So, two airplanes is the entire art budget.
For the United States of America.
For the United States of America.
So, that's a little messed up.
Yeah.
You know,
and that is messed up.
Lightly.
And so it's just, and despite that,
I mean, have you seen Ken Robinson's talk on TED?
I haven't, but I've been told about to see it.
You have to see that talk. So, you know, is our schools killing creativity?
Yes.
And it's, I mean, it's one of the most, I think it's the most popular talk on TED.
Really?
And it's when I watched it, I mean, I immediately, you know, saved it to my hard drive and watched it again. And I mean, he makes the point so clearly, that ultimately creative thinking is what is driving forward civilization, technology, all these things.
Right.
And that the arts, you know, and music are important for the brain to develop creative approaches to problem solving.
Sure.
And so regardless of thinking that somebody has to become an artist as a career, right? Having arts and music in school is good for brain development.
Right.
You know, and the fact that it's being cut, you know, ultimately is not going to serve society well at all.
Right.
Because we need people to come up with creative solutions to the problems that are facing, you know, society over coming generations.
Sure.
And creativity, whether it is in science or in politics or in communication or whatever, is critical.
Right.
You know, and so from that perspective, you know, he has one analogy of a woman who, you know, today would have been diagnosed with ADD, but in the reality was a dancer, you know, and that she couldn't sit still and she was fidgeting all the time.
Right.
But she went on to become, you know, a highly successful dancer once, luckily for her, when she was young, someone identified that that's what she was.
Right.
That she didn't have ADD. She didn't have a problem. She didn't have a brain disorder. She was just, she thought differently, you know, and having a school system that can really take advantage of what everybody has to offer and recognize that everybody's different.
Right.
And our school system right now assumes that everybody's the same. And they all have to pass the same experience.
Test. Yep.
So, you know, so to have a 1 billion out of 3.9 trillion, you know, focused on creativity.
Right.
It's misguided on a level that is so high.
Right.
And what can be done about that?
Yeah.
You know, it's like how that is not something that's going to change quickly when you're talking about that big of a discrepancy between our government's, you know, appreciation for war and science, you know, as opposed to the arts and creativity.
Right.
So I think that's where like the only solution is for people to get involved. So I understand that, you know, obviously our industry is one of many creative industries. So
yes.
Of course there's cities where there aren't visual effects studios or game studios. And mm-hmm. if you like to draw and you want to be an artist, it's going to be harder,
mm-hmm.
but that doesn't mean that art should be cut from school.
No. And there's no reason why you can't create an industry too, you know, be mm-hmm. smart or fosters all kinds of stuff. There's all kinds of stimulation that happens all over the place. And it's in a very strange thing, like Kansas City, right? Google mm-hmm. Fiber goes into Kansas City, right. A tech boom happens.
Yeah.
All you did is install a fiber connection.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you gotta, there's ways that are really interesting that you can do.
Yeah, of course.
And that's a creative solution.
Yeah, there's nothing negative on a global scale, you know, by providing better education.
Right.
And including art as part of that.
Yeah.
You know, but the myopic view of government, you know, where you have politicians that are thinking about getting reelected every 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
Are focusing on differences they can make within 1 to 4 years.
Yes.
Because they want to show what they did so they can get reelected. And education is an investment that takes a generation to see the effect of. That if you're going to invest more money in education, it might not be for 20 years that you start to see the effect that that change had on society.
Yeah.
And how do politicians get reelected on that?
Right.
And that is a big problem.
Well, most of the politicians I feel now are mostly being pushing fear. Mm-hmm. Fear is like the number one driving force of politics right now, because if you don't do this, something bad will happen, yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. But the problem
that's why the military budget is
of course,
you know,
of course. That's what I was getting at, is that the military budget is really high because they can immediately see a protection defense, yeah. Right?
Right.
But
and you know, if all the military if all the, you know, war related expenses were operated by the government, that'd be one thing, but they're right. not. They're operated by the private sector.
Right.
So that's $650 billion. A lot of that is going to private corporations.
Sure.
That are profiting off of this ridiculous budget.
Right.
You know, and therefore they have insane amounts of money to lobby to continue to get more. So it's in the interest of these corporations that are building tanks and bombers and weapons and bullets. It's in their interest
right.
to have CNN and MSNBC and Fox News and all of the media outlets constantly portray fear.
Right.
You know, whether it's ISIS or whether it's North Korea or whatever, so that the population will continue to approve, you know, this insane spending on war.
Right. Well, I didn't want to get too political about it, but I think it's important because that's really where a lot of the art is necessarily mm-hmm. going away. And it's the same thing that I was going to say, you know, if I say, if you don't do this now, tomorrow something will happen. But I said, if you don't do this now, 50 years from now
right.
will happen. You know, you can talk about global warming or education, right?
Right.
You will have a country full of stupid people or yeah. people that are not creative or just lack any yeah. kind of knowledge. And I think that's a really, yeah. that is a threat.
It is. And, you know, it's like we have, you know, there's a $1.1 trillion of student loan debt in the United States now.
Yeah.
Right. And that's obscene, A.
Yeah.
But B, when you look at a budget of $3.9 trillion and you look how much money students are borrowing to go to school.
Right.
Right. A year in the United States, the government could afford to pay that. If they reduce the defense budget by 10%.
Right.
Right. 10%, 10 to 20, then college could be free in right. the United States, like it is in a lot of other countries.
Right.
So, you know, in the end, this complete lack of focus on education, arts education, it's right. not—it's not good for anybody.
No.
And it's a global problem.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, in you know, I had another slide, which wasn't just about America. You know, yes, it's an issue in California, Los Angeles, but it's an issue in Canada. It's an issue in the UK, even in Portugal. Mm-hmm. You know, like I just did some research for Portugal, and they've cut a huge percentage of their budgets for education and the arts.
Right, right, right. Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about education, because I think another thing that's important that you do at Noman, and it's something that you really wanted to make sure happened, is obviously the people that graduate from Noman are pretty good. They're mm-hmm. really good. And there's a reason you do that is you vet the people coming in, right?
Yeah.
And that's an important process that you have to go through that nearly every other major university does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
they go and it's like, if you're going to graduate from this school, mm-hmm. this school has to have a good reputation. So right. therefore you have to come in good and come out great.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so you, and we're going to provide the tool to make you go from good to great.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, if I, my, there was, okay, here's an example. It was at Rice University. I was a very good university. One of the top architecture schools in the world. There was one guy who just was just fucking off all day long, and just they did the worst thing. And there were people in class that were going to the dean and say, if you let this person graduate, mm-hmm. it devalues my yeah. degree.
Yeah.
And so there was a petition to from the students
wow.
to not have him graduate because they were frustrated because they knew that he was just getting sliding by.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted value in their education.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they felt that if this guy goes out there.
Good for them.
You know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I thought it was an important thing.
Yeah.
Now, it's a little extreme.
Yeah.
But it's important to say, you know, when someone comes out of Noman, mm-hmm. they are trained by some of the best people in the industry. But they've got there because they have to have a portfolio, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we only have people for, you know, 2 to 3 years. That's the length of our two, you know, full-time programs.
Right.
2 to 3 years is, from some people's perspective, a long amount of time, but from our perspective, a very, very short
That's
amount
very
of time.
That's very short, yeah.
So whatever they bring to the table when they show up at Noman yeah. is important,
right?
And has a huge impact on what they will get out of the 2 to 3 years that they spend in our program.
Right.
Whether somebody is, you know, 20 years old or 30 years old. You know,
sure.
The average student who's starting is around 24, I'd say.
Right.
You know, but the age range is 20 to 50.
Yeah.
You know, like we have 50-year-olds enter the program.
Yeah, because they suddenly realize like, oh, crap, right. I have missed out on this thing that I dreamed to do.
And so what you bring to the table is hugely important. And so I think that with certain things,
right.
How do you qualify somebody's potential, right? Well, if you look at Ivy League schools like Harvard or Stanford or whatever, they look at GPA. They look at your SAT score. They look at, they have to have something to judge
right.
whether you have the potential to survive in an intensely academic environment. So with the arts, you know, what do you do? Mm-hmm. Well, a portfolio requirement is the obvious thing. Can you draw, or are you? Do you have a good eye for composition and light with photography? Or
right.
like, there needs to be something visual,
right,
that expresses your ability to succeed in a visual industry,
right?
And so, ultimately, becomes a question of what is the school offering, and what is the impression to the student of what they think the school is offering?
Okay,
if somebody goes to study fine art, that person probably knows that it's going to be very difficult to succeed
sure.
As a gallery artist. You're just kind of like more like of a common knowledge mm-hmm. issue. If somebody goes to college and decides to major in philosophy, they know that that's going to be
their pretty much job as a philosopher.
Academic right. road. They're yeah. going to have to get a master's, a PhD, and teach. that's pretty much it.
That's it.
That's what a friend of mine did. I mean, he was in school and he was 32 until he got his PhD and became a philosophy professor.
Right.
But if somebody goes to a program that's called, you know, a game design program or a visual effects program or mm. whatever, like it's pretty clear that that person is hoping to get a job doing that,
mm-hmm.
right? And so when somebody shows up at Noman, they're showing up there because they want to work in the industry.
Mm-hmm.
It's not because they want to find themselves. It's not because they're thinking that there's no chance of success. It's like they've kind of made a decision
yeah.
that they want to work in the video game industry. They want to work in the film industry. They want to work in commercials. Like, we know that that's what people are thinking when they show up at Noman.
So it's kind of like when you went to Penn, mm-hmm. after 2 years, then you start making that decision. They've already gone through that 2 years at the beginning. They
right.
know they know what their major is.
Right. I mean, a lot of people show up at Noman and are not sure what part of the industry they want to work in.
Like okay.
whether they're going to be interested in modeling and texturing or lighting and rendering and compositing.
Well,
right. Yeah. But they know it's the industry that they
sure.
want.
Sure.
So I feel that it's, you know, and school's expensive. You know, Noman's expensive.
Sure.
We're cheaper than a lot of the other schools, but it's still expensive.
Mm-hmm.
So because of that, if somebody's going to put that kind of investment of time and money, I feel that we should do everything we can to try and qualify that person.
Mm-hmm.
And so for us, it's a portfolio requirement.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if somebody shows up at Noman, we will look at their work and give them a crit on the spot, you know, and tell them right away whether or not we think they have the potential of getting into mm-hmm. the program and succeeding.
And what's the size of your classes generally? I mean, how many students you have at the school at any given time?
We have about 200 in the full time program.
200,
450 total, because we have a lot of extension students.
Right, and because I know, because that's really small considering really how many people mm-hmm. I know that graduated Noman that work in the industry.
Right,
and I'm saying this for a reason, because I know certain other schools, as an example, they go ahead and take whoever the hell they want mm-hmm. and graduate 500 people a month.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's no
way.
You're
not exaggerating. I mean, that's...
No, I'm not exaggerating.
The Art Institute's, 45,000 students across 45 campuses.
Yeah.
With no portfolio requirement to get into any of their programs.
Right.
That is unethical.
That's unethical because they're making false promises. Exactly. And they go out, and here's the other thing is, you go on TV, mm-hmm. you don't have a job, so you're watching daytime TV and watching Oprah or whatever else is going on. Mm-hmm. And what are the ads coming in? Oh, you don't have a job, you can't figure out what to do? Come here.
Right.
Give us all your money mm-hmm. and you'll work at Pixar. And that's the false promise.
I know. Because the thing is, when you have a school of that size, with that many students, they're going to be success stories.
Right.
Right. Because there's going to be somebody who's just talented and passionate who just ended up at one of those schools who was meant to succeed no matter where they went to school. Yep. Because there's people like that, obviously. And those schools, in a predatory way, then latch onto those graduates and put them in their commercials.
Right.
But some of those schools might only have placement rates of 5%, mm-hmm. right? Which is abysmal.
Right. So 95% of the people graduate with a massive debt and no job.
Right. Not a job that's related to what their course of study was.
Right.
And so it's easy for them, because of their scale, to make it appear in their advertising material that they have all these successful graduates and mm-hmm. that if you come here, you will get a job, but it's misleading.
Yeah.
So I have issue with that.
No, I know. I think all of it needs to be reformed in a lot of ways, because I think that's unethical, and that's a lot of things that puts a bad mark mm-hmm. on the creative process.
Right.
And that's a little bit of the supply demand thing I'm talking about. So an example, the reason I want to go back to what I first said at the beginning, mm-hmm. you formed Noman out of a frustration.
Yeah.
You came from a very organized, highly competitive education system, even though it wasn't for you, but you know what an education system is supposed to do to make you the best it is or whatever it is. Yeah. But you just took that idea and you put it into a different curriculum.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. That Noman is hard. Yeah. Noman is 80-hour weeks for 2 to 3 years, and it's very competitive and it's very difficult, but it's competitive in a positive way.
Right.
But the most important thing about it is that you're supported. That like all of your teachers have jobs.
Right.
Doing exactly what it is that they're teaching.
Right.
So if somebody's teaching a rigging class, they're a rigger at a studio. If somebody's teaching a design class, they're a designer, at a studio. Right. So that all the information you're getting is pertinent, is relevant, is current, because mm-hmm. things change a lot in our industry. Because that was my frustration. In the few art classes I did have, the mm-hmm. teachers didn't appreciate what my interests were. I couldn't relate to them. So it was hard for me to then look up to them and want to trust them. And so major trust issues with adults and teachers, by the time I was 20.
Right.
And so finding that school that I wished I could find, because I looked so hard for a school to go to when I was trying to get access to the Silicon Graphics computers, mm-hmm. and I couldn't find anything that was exactly what I wanted. I found Art Center because they had the computers, but they didn't have classes.
Yep.
And so the hope with Noman was just to create something that was a school I could continue to study at that point.
Right.
So it was a school for the younger me, but also when I started Noman, I felt I had so much left to learn. And most of our students at the beginning were other professionals, mm-hmm. As extension. So just knowing that I'm going to be learning for the rest of my career. Mm-hmm. And so I just wanted to create an environment where I could facilitate that selfishly for myself, that I want to learn from this artist and from this artist and from this artist.
Yeah. I got very lucky at Rice because it was a similar situation to you. Mm-hmm. They had just opened up Ravel, which is what they called it, which is a Rice Advanced Visualization Lab, right? Mm-hmm. And they were trying to get people to do this stuff, but no one knew what they were doing.
Yeah.
No one knew it. One person who ran the lab to make sure all the computers were working mm-hmm. and taught the classes, she taught herself everything so that she could teach us. So she was literally reading the book and the next day mm-hmm. telling us what she read to get us up there. And her name was Shisha Van Horn, and she became a really good friend of mine. Mm-hmm. And I love Shisha. I really think that she did a really big difference for me. But she was flying by the seat of her pants, But I was driven. I was like, no, I'm going to do this. We had all these SGIs. Mm-hmm. This is an architecture school. Keep this in mind. They got all these SGIs. People were using them to check their email. I was the only one using Wavefront on it.
Right.
And I was getting frustrated with Wavefront because it's not necessarily the best tool for architecture.
Right?
No. No. And right. So I was like, oh, so you know, if 3D Studio Max was going to work better for me. But I did everything. I learned everything. Mm-hmm. And eventually it came out of that. But you have to put in some passion into it.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I want to talk a little bit more. Let's talk about some positive things.
Okay.
What are some of the things that have evolved since you? How old is Noman now?
18 years.
18 years. Oh, yeah. So, and considering how young this industry is, you pretty much started at the beginning of it in a sense. What are some of the things that have developed out of there that in that 18 years that you're most proud of?
I mean, the full-time programs, you know, because we didn't start with that. You know, because we started as extension so artists from studios could get together and share ideas. That was the origin of Noman.
Okay.
And so that's what it was for a while, for the first year. Mm-hmm. And then people wanted to get into the industry, wanted classes, and we started to add classes for them and then added a full-time program. And our first full-time graduates are from, you know, let's say probably like around 2000. Mm-hmm. So we have people out there who graduated 15 years ago.
Right.
And so from those, you know, initial graduates to today, you know, the thing that makes me the most proud is graduation, we do graduation every 6 months and it's, you know, between 15 to 30 people at graduation. So it's pretty small groups.
Yeah.
And at graduation, you know, I'm seeing, and we show the reels at graduation.
That's awesome.
And to see what happens to people in 2 to 3 years. Just to remember where they were when they started.
But you kind of, because it's so small, you know every student.
Oh yeah, of course, because we're tiny, you know, so. And, you know, as of this summer, I'm now teaching a new class for term one students. So like I have all of them, you know, so every student I have in term one and most of the students I have in their last term.
Mm-hmm.
And to see the change that happens to people over the course of that time, and then to meet their husbands, wives, kids, parents, grandparents at graduation and hear so many stories about, you know, my son was always so talented, but we never knew what he was going to do. And we're so thankful that he found Noman and he already has a job.
Such a familiar story.
Because, you know, a lot of our graduates have jobs when they graduate.
Yeah.
I mean, most of our students, 95% of our students get a job within 6 months of graduation, but before they graduate, like in their last term, a lot of students get a job.
But I also hear that people who have jobs go back to Noman and takes extension classes as well.
Lots of people do. So, but that's what makes me the most proud is just knowing that we made a difference.
Yeah.
You know, that we took somebody ultimately who was like me when I was their age.
Yeah.
And gave them confidence and gave them a community and made them feel optimistic about the future.
Right.
To know that things are going to be okay. You've now started a career that you're excited about, that you're passionate about.
Right.
That's rewarding.
Yeah. Well, that's absolutely
It's humbling is the better word.
Yeah.
It's, you know, absolutely it's very trippy and surreal for me at graduation to feel like I put this weird thing in motion that is so much bigger than me. Because Noma's not about me at all. I mean, we have 80 teachers. I'm one.
Right.
You know, it's never been about me. It's about finding people way better than me, way smarter than me, more talented than me, more experienced than me, and hoping that they would trust my idea and support it.
Yeah.
And so I'm very lucky.
Yeah, and you bring in some really great lecturers. I mean, obviously, I've seen the people that have gone through Noman and given talks and stuff, and those are
so much support from so many cool people.
Isn't it crazy good people?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, whether it's the events or the Noman workshop or teachers and studios. I mean, so many, ever since the beginning, studios were so supportive of letting their artists teach at Noman, and especially in 97 when, you know, there weren't that many places to pull artists from, and I really needed to get, you know, hope that they would give permission. You know, to go to Warner Digital or Pacific Ocean Post or DD or DreamWorks and hope that their artists could teach.
Yeah.
And all of them at the beginning were just, of course.
Sure.
You know, and all the artists were into it because everybody was so aware the stuff was so new and dynamic and changing that they all wanted to learn from each other.
Yeah.
It's like we've done DVDs with one amazing artist and then that person's like, oh, you got to get this friend of mine who's amazing, but I've never watched him work. And like, meaning like this super professional really wants to watch this other professional work so they can learn from them.
Right.
Like it doesn't matter how old you are, how experienced you are.
Right.
I think we all remain very aware of what we're not good at.
Yeah.
What we hope to be good at.
Yeah.
That feeling doesn't seem to go away.
I think there's a constant, for me, there's a constant change, right? Like, I mean, I was an architect for a while. I mean, I've always been into the creative ideas, right? Mm-hmm. So I was an architect for a while, and then I was not quite my free. And then I went to visual effects for quite a while. Mm-hmm. And now I'm like, now I want to do more R&D work and do stuff and get together with, I mean, to be honest, like running this podcast has been an amazing thing for me. Mm-hmm. I've met so many amazing people, and I've been able to talk and sort of really fill my brain of where can we go from here. So it's really kind of, you'll never really know, but you know you're creative. And right. I think that's a really beautiful thing. But I think what you guys are doing is incredible. What do you want to do from here? Like, what's the next part of the growth for Noman for you?
I mean, we've continued to grow, but slowly over 18 years.
Well, not necessarily in terms of size,
but I think right now our priority is like, we'll continue to grow slowly, but our focus is the industry and that's who we serve.
Okay.
So we'll only grow to a point that we can maintain our placement rate.
Sure.
And therefore, what can we do to guarantee the success of our students? That's our priority. Sure. If anything's going to change, what makes Noman better?
Have you considered serving other similar or related industries?
No. I mean, we'll remain entertainment industry focused. Okay. So, I mean, I think I can't say no forever, but
right.
at least for the foreseeable future, there's so much change going on in the game industry and growth in the game industry that's been a change for Noman over the last few years.
Yeah.
You know, and like we now, as of a year ago, we started our games track and our full-time program.
Right.
So that was in response to, you know, the growth of the industry, the need for artists and people wanting to get into it.
Right.
So reacting and responding to that.
The game industry is changing, I mean, just radically.
It hasn't stopped changing since, you know, 77 when the Atari came out.
I know, but it's going to obliterate the entertainment industry in terms of size.
It already has.
I know it has, but it's going to be like 3-4 times more than the entire entertainment industry.
Oh yeah, this year it's passing, you know, all filmed entertainment.
Right.
So whether it's, you know, TV, film, globally,
right.
you know, video game sales are passing it this year.
Right.
And it'll just continue to grow.
Yeah, and especially like mobile gaming is surpassing almost non-mobile gaming.
I know, it's amazing. So that creates jobs and that creates opportunity. Yeah. And so obviously
someone has to design those games.
In the beginning of Noman, everybody wanted to work in visual effects and movies. Everybody wanted to work at ILM. They wanted to work on that kind of stuff. Now about half of our students want to work in games. And it's that percentage is growing. So like right now it's half. I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, 5 years from now, it's 75% of the people who come to Noman who want to work in games. Because working in games is becoming cooler and cooler because the quality of the content's getting better.
Yeah. And you know, games are becoming so much more cinematic. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean, you play The Last of Us, you play, you know, Dragon Age, you play Shadow of Mordor. I mean, like,
there's Bioshock Infinite.
Oh, man. They're so engaging and so cool. So just imagine another 5 or 10 years.
And, I know.
You know.
And it's an art form that I think is really important. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, as an example, when I was playing Bioshock Infinite, I actually got frustrated with the game part of it because the story was so good that I almost wished there was a mode where I could just experience the game entirely.
That's a big thing now on YouTube is watching people play games.
Twitch mm-hmm. has more subscribers than YouTube.
Yeah. It's nuts. And my son does that. He spends a lot of time on YouTube watching certain channels, like this guy Jacksepticeye, who's pretty entertaining and plays lots of games. And, you know, Griffin finds it just as entertaining to watch people play as opposed to play himself.
Right.
But for certain things that are very narrative, you know, sometimes just watching somebody go through the games, so you don't have to play it, but you're just watching the story unfold. The fact that people are doing that, who would have thought 20 years ago that people would go online just to watch people play games.
If you look at something, you know, just let's use an example, right? People say, that's insane. Why would you just watch someone play a game and not play yourself? Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of people watch basketball and don't play basketball.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Yeah. It's like, I may not be good at basketball. I may like to play every now and then, but I love to watch a good game of basketball because that guy's much better than I am. And I'll never necessarily be as good at that person, but that's going to be an exciting game to watch.
Exactly. That's a perfect point. Yeah.
So,
it's funny. So I think, you know, so the future for us is just responding to what changes happen around us. Because, right. you know, it's not our role to foresee the future. It's our role to listen to the industry.
Yeah.
So as the industry changes because of us being connected to it with our instructors, that we, because it changes fast yet slowly. Things don't change in a day. They change maybe in a year.
Right.
And so we just have to continue to listen.
Right.
You know, and then that's what will guide where we go. I mean, I think the only big change we're making is that we're pursuing degrees.
Sure.
You know, so like that'll be a difference for Noman, where a year from now-ish, right. you know, our full-time program will be a degree.
Well, one thing I think that's going to start happening to you, and I know you're probably in the back of your mind getting ready for it. It's not, the demand isn't quite there yet, but it will be. Mm-hmm. Especially, I'm going to be talking to Kevin Mack today, mm-hmm. and he's going to be showing fine art in a VR setting, right?
Yeah.
Or fine art, or his art in a VR setting.
Awesome.
And that's going to be a renaissance again, or a revolution in terms of content. It's going to mm-hmm. be a whole new medium, which we haven't even figured out how that works.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And so that could be a next thing, then in the education ideas of creating virtual environments and right. creating virtual content.
Exactly. But but the industry needs to figure that out.
No one figured it out.
You know? Yeah. And so it's because it's, so that's a question.
Yeah.
Yeah. We don't know. You know, it's exciting.
It is exciting.
That more change is coming, and that it's going to most likely create new experiences.
Yeah.
And that's going to be new content.
Yeah.
You know, and that, you know, will that replace or be in addition to, meaning that you have film and commercials and games and this VR content as right. an additional, you know, revenue stream for the industry, meaning an additional area for employment.
Well, you know, movies didn't kill books.
Right.
So I think that there's place for all kinds of art forms, yeah. all kinds of experiences, you know?
Exactly.
So, yeah. And it's not to say that it's like, oh, I'd rather watch this on the Oculus. I think that's going to be a different experience. The mm-hmm. way that a movie's cut together mm-hmm. is going to be different than the ways a movie's cut together on the Oculus, right? Like watching a Michael Bay movie is awesome. It's fun. It's exciting. Mm-hmm. You do that on an Oculus, that's going to be a very difficult thing to watch.
Right. I know. So I'm curious. I mean, it's, you know, I mean, I've only used an Oculus a couple of times, right. you know, but, you know, Greg Downing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so Greg came over the other day and, you know, brought his, the Samsung
yeah,
phone
yeah.
and some of his content that him and Eric have been making on yeah. that. And it was rad.
I know.
And like
I
there
know.
Was a bunch of us over for dinner and,
I didn't bring my Gear VR here, yeah. but we were creating some stuff as well.
Cool.
Right.
I mean, and like everybody at dinner, just like, I mean, cause everybody was trying it on and everybody just had the biggest smiles on their faces
right.
and the content that they're, you know, they're taking a lot of stuff they did for Dome Theaters and whatever, and just transitioning mm-hmm. it to that. And it was, everybody, including not non-CG people that mm-hmm. were there, mm-hmm. were so genuinely excited by it. Mm. That's a good thing. That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? And his content wasn't games. His content was just
experience. Yeah.
You know, you're floating over the bow of a ship, looking down at the dolphins swimming in the water and up yeah. in the sky, and you're just there.
Yeah. 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 I saw it. I was just really, really impressed. I did a podcast with Eric.
Their stuff is awesome.
I think it's really cool, and I think that there's definitely a future there that's bright, and I want to make sure we come away from that with that message.
Yeah.
We just need to make sure that we have support for it.
Yeah, no, I think you have to stay optimistic.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't help to be bitter about the past and to be bitter about the present. You know, it's better to just figure out how you can make change.
Yeah.
You know, and that's where something I said in my talk, which I believe, you know, strongly, like it's not about Noman. I'm not trying to promote Noman. I'm trying to promote the idea that people around the world should get involved. People right. around the world should start schools and go speak at high schools and talk to kids. And like the community that we have should get involved on a global basis.
Right.
Noman's going to continue to be Noman, a small school in Hollywood.
Right.
You know, so like we're not going to open Noman Paris, Noman London. That's not happening.
Right.
You know, and so we want to see our community grow and thrive, you know, yeah. and so that all of this content, you know, out there has talented artists to contribute to, and that these artists will figure out ways to create more jobs.
Yeah, absolutely.
If anybody's going to figure it out, it's going to be our community.
Yeah. Yep. Indeed.
So,
all right. Well, Alex, this has been awesome. We're just in an hour, and I think we can definitely leave on a positive note now. I feel better because I know it was a little sad. And it's just true. You know, we have to talk about the reality of it, and that's fine. And I think people need to know the reality of it. But it's not all. There's a lot of hope, and there's a lot of things, and there's things that people need to do. And going over and finding government funding and finding ways to promote that, or finding ways that you can support people that are supporting the arts is important in that process. So. Yeah. All right.
I think the future is bright.
Thanks, Alex. All right. Thank you. We're going to let the last bucket drop, which is my sign off, because, you know, we'd have the little buckets to go. All right. Thank you, guys. Bye.